Welcome to another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. Today, Laurie and I are very happy to welcome Greg Blomberg, one of the Lopezians who came in the 60s, and you will hear quite a bit about the history of people starting in those days to find their way back to the land on Lopez Island.
So, Greg, we've been sitting here just having a brief conversation before the radio show began, and you were telling us what it was like to come to Lopez as a young person in his 20s, and what it was like to join this community of farmers and fisher folk on Lopez. Can you begin by telling us a little bit about what brought you here?
Well, if I can just take a minute or two to say that I was born in Minnesota and I grew up there. By the time I was, my mother died. She was an artist, and she and I had a very close relationship. And she died when I was 13. Train hit her car, and kind of a weird set of circumstances. And anyway, she was she's been an inspiration my whole life, one of the things that I remember from her that I tell to people is that she believed that we only had the right to replace ourselves, and she died when I was 13. So this is in the 50s, early 50s, and she had the idea that the population was an issue then. But I don't know where she got that from, and I wish that she'd have lived long enough to tell me. But anyway, an interesting thing about her, and there was a posthumous show for her at the Walker Art Gallery in Minneapolis after she died. But anyway, my father was an accountant, and I didn't want anything to do with that. And I left there. I went to a couple years of a gunsmithing school, and then I moved to Denver. I had a mountain climbing manufacturing business, and met and married my wife Edie, my first wife, and. I was involved in mountain climbing and that kind of thing, and eventually it came time to leave from Denver where we were living, and we had two possibilities. One was we wanted to homestead. We had the idea that it'd be fun to go back to the land, but we also thought the idea of sailing, of having a boat, would be fun. And so there was a choice of Montana or Washington is what it came down to, and it seemed like you wanted to sail before you settled down. So we came to Washington, lived down Sound for about a year and a half, and with the boat that we got, a 32-foot sailboat, we were sailing around, and we took one summer off to just sail, and we landed on Lopez, and we met some of the most marvelous people ever. People that just absolutely amazed us in their welcoming. And I think that Lopez still has a good measure of that. Just a place where, people are, that way. And I don't know how long, how far back that might have gone. But I know that I've never wanted to stop the ferry and say nobody else can come here. It is a concern, the numbers of population, the development, and such like that. On an island, which is obviously a finite place, but still, it's a very, very sweet community, and it means everything to me. But these old timers were such marvelous people, and we were coming here as flower children, kind of like. I was born in an awkward time. I was too young to be a beatnik, and really kind of too old to be a hippie. But we were closer to the hippie thing, so we were coming as flower children, and these people would just just absolutely welcomed us, and then we met people like Frances Kring, who showed us what a flower child really was. I mean, this woman grew flowers like crazy. I mean, it was just marvelous and so generous and sweet. And to this day, we are growing plants and that we got from Francis and from Island Old Timers. I mean, potatoes. We've got a potato called Bucket of Hill. It's an old island variety. We've got dry beans, a lima, the only lima that could ever come close to being growing here on Lopez, and it's adapted. We save seed every year. Irene has three other dry beans that came from her, and I don't know what all, but these were all old-time things. Our raspberries are those old-time raspberries and stuff, and and so... anyway, because...
Just as an aside here, when Greg Eward and I interviewed the Krings for Kindred Spirits, Mrs. Kring gave me a little bag of beans back, and that was, you know, and that was 15 years ago. I mean, she just, that was part of what she loved, wasn't it? Sharing the land, sharing her flowers, sharing her beans. It was just, you know, it was the funniest little thing that when I left, she said, here, here's this little brown bag. Take it home, honey. It was lovely.
That that old house that they lived in, that, they weren't the first people that lived there. When they bought that house, Frances told me, she took me into that house and she said, here's where the phone was. Did she tell you that story?
No.
She said, the wall phone, and the phone company was right there by the place there. And
that little house that later became the...
Yeah, now Sona and Ashley are living
right
there. But anyway... the phone was right there on the wall, and when the phone company was there, so a phone call would come in, and they'd say, I want, you know, this number, but there was like nine party lines. Now, they would ring that party line, they would ring
so
the special
times.
Ring for that person, but then all those people would pick it up, and this, right next to where the phone was, right below where the phone was, are two grooves worn in the floor by the woman that would listen to all the things, and the more exciting the topic got, the more she'd shuffle her feet, and she wore, actually, they're still there in the floor of that house, you know. I mean, it's just too much, you know. But the old timers here, you know, like I say, they were, you know, really welcoming, because, and they were self-sufficient people, and they were self-realized people. They knew how to build, you know, a house or a pig pen, and they knew how to garden and farm, and about the salmon and stuff like that. And it was pretty amazing to be on the island with people that, like Emil Fagerholm, was old enough to have remembered when it was a trail to Richardson. It wasn't a dirt road, it was a trail. And he said later on, when there was a dirt road there, people wave now. He said, nobody wave. They stop and get off, and they'd sit on a rock or something and talk. You know, it's like, you know, when you saw somebody coming on the road, well, it was a big deal, you know. And
have a visit.
He also told about being having a bunch of strawberries, and they were going to take them to the Richardson dock there, where the ferry steamer came in from Seattle, and then they'd take them down to the farmer's market in Seattle. And he had the whole skiff load, a rowboat full of strawberries that he'd caught, and I mean that he'd grown, and he took them down to McArdle Bay there, and put them in his boat, and then he was rowing to the dock, and the salmon were running, and there were so many salmon at that time that there were lots of jumpers, and he was like, started to get nervous, and sure enough, a salmon jumped into his boat, and he started grabbing for that salmon, and it was slipping out of his hands. And before he could get the salmon thrown back into the water, the whole load of strawberries was ruined, you know. But I mean, you know, it was you know, pretty interesting. And you know, Gerhardt, Kring told me a lot of the old timers' stories, and it was pretty wonderful, because, see, we don't realize that what we see when we come to Lopez, we think that's kind of like the beginning of Lopez history, but of course we know it wasn't, and things were vastly different. And just 20 years before I came to Lopez, there wasn't power 24 hours a day on the island. There was a power plant, and it produced electricity. A diesel generator produced electricity for the island, and there wasn't cable to the mainland yet. And that they'd turn the electricity on in the morning, and about 5 a.m. or so, so the farmers could milk the cows. And then I think he told me that it was off during the middle of the day for a little while, and then it'd come back on in the afternoon, And the farmers would milk again, and about 9, 10 o'clock at night, they'd flip the switch, and you were in the dark then until the morning, or at least you didn't have the power. And
went back to your kerosene lamp.
Yeah, oh, for sure. They had candles and kerosene lamps. I mean, that was, you know, you had them everywhere. And the other thing is that he told me is that there weren't tractors. You know, we think of the tractors as being, you know, just one of those things that's always been here. And I would have thought that too. But Garrett said that the first gas tractor, little compact, like modern type tractor that they that there was came to Shaw Island, and a bunch of the Lopez guys went over to Shaw to see it, you know, just to see what it was like, you know, and so then eventually they all had tractors, but that they only retired their, you know, their horse gear, you know, very few years before that.
So when are we talking about?
Well,
here?
We're talking, you know, I was here in 68, and about you know 1950. 49, 50 is when they first started to have tractors here, little tractors, you know, the ordinary kind of tractors. And
so they're farming with horses up until then.
They're farming with horses, and all the barns were full of horse tack. And if you go down to Gerhardt's, there's still horse tack hanging up there, you know. So anyway, it's interesting, you know. And also there was a thing, what was it recently about Willie Cousins, you know, in the historical thing, but anyway, I mean, you talk about a character, I never met him, you know, it would have been really dandy to meet the guy, but he was so such an interesting guy that he was always documenting things. And in that old barn that now is owned by Kip Greenthal, but on that place there, it, up in the rafters, when they re-roofed that barn, I don't know when he and his brother built the barn, but anyway, when they were building the barn, I think it was like 1918 or something like that, he had an experience up on a ladder putting up rafters, and he left a note there in a jar right at the corner that they found when they re-roofed it the first time. And the note said, we was up in the rafters, working on the barn, and there came a terrific quake. And he says, I thought she was coming down, but she held fast. And signed it Willie Cousins and dated it. Now, I don't know if that note is in the Historical Society Museum, but it should be. And the old timers all talked about that. So I'm pretty sure that was a fact. And I'm pretty sure you could probably even figure out what quake it was, you know, if you were to go back, because they were recording that kind of stuff. But he also would, people would find rail fencing, his old rail fences, and then have WC and the date that he put the last rail on his fence, you know, and just carved into the rail, you know. So
he had a sense of history.
Yeah, pretty delightful. Well, because of that, I've always, when I build everything, I put little time capsules in everything, you know. And one time, in one of the walls of the house, we put a bottle of whiskey, which I hope someday somebody will find, you know, because it will have been well aged by then, you know. And that'd be kind of fun. But also little notes and things like that, you know, are we've done that from the very beginning, just because of that, the influence of Willie Cousins. It's kind of fun. Well, when I came here, the ferry was the Vashon. The Vashon was this old, beautiful old ferry with all brass fittings everywhere. You could look down into the engine room, and the big pistons would go pump, 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 really? Like that, you know. And it took an hour and a half to get from Lopez to the mainland. And if you lived on San Juan Island, it took you 3 hours to get over to the mainland and 3 hours to come back.
How many cars would take with the car?
No, I don't know. I
it's
don't,
probably small,
you know,
though.
Maybe 40, 50, I don't know. But anyway, it was quite a deal to go to the mainland. And even if you got there, I mean, Mount Vernon was nothing. It was nothing. I mean, there was one little hardware store over there, you know. I mean, it's crazy. There was one road going out of Anacortes, and it wasn't divided. There was a right-hand lane going and a left-hand lane coming back, and that was it, you know. Things have changed a lot, you know, in the whole area.
That was still that way when we first came, you know. there was just this
yeah.
little road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. anyway, pretty interesting, you know, times back then. And you know, you look back on it and it's really charming, but there was nothing much charming about spending, you know, 6 hours if you were from San Juan going to the mainland and back. But the ferry would go over, would start on San Juan in the morning, and it would pick up people at the islands and it'd take them to the mainland, drop them off, come back. And then it would go back over one more time, and then in the evening it would come back. That was it. And so there was, you know, two trips over, two trips back.
So I'm guessing you found yourself staying put.
Yeah. Yeah, people stayed on the island more. You know, this idea of, shopping on the mainland wasn't quite so prevalent, I guess, you know. Well, there was nothing to buy here either, you know. We just right. lived on what there was, you know. I mean, there was Bill Carpenter's store. And when we first got here, Bill Carpenter was in the building that's the fudge factory building there.
Yeah.
And the remnants of the old post office was in that store in a corner. And it still said, you know, Lopez Post Office, but the actual post office then was across the street in a little pillbox that was there for a long time and now has been remodeled. But anyway, when we came to the island, we just kind of lived, I don't know. There's so many stories. I mean, it's such good stories. Actually, just buying the land. We had this boat. It was going to buy the land for us. And the land was going to come, the first piece of land that we bought, well, we ended up buying four different pieces, but put them together as one. But the land was coming from Ted Ritchie. We made a date with him to meet him in Northgate to get the deed and to give him the money. But when we went down to Seattle, lo and behold, the people hadn't paid for the boat yet, so the boatyard didn't have the money. So we went in big disappointment to meet Ted at Northgate at some restaurant, I guess, or something. But anyway, we went in there and Ted says, well, you know, I did bring the deed, you know, so I'll sign that over. And when you get the money, well, you got to give it to me, you know, or you give it to me, you know. I mean, it's like that, you know, people, you know, that's the way people lived. And, you know, anyway, there was, oh, my God, the people here, such gorgeous people. I mean, just absolutely gorgeous. And
I think you'd said earlier, too, something about you guys being the young upstarts coming from and the older farm folk and how their young people had already left. So they were eager. Tell us a little bit about that again, too.
Well, anyway, that seemed to be the case, that we were, you know, very welcomed. And I think that even though nobody ever really said it, I don't think in so many words, but I think it was because most of the people who lived here then that became the old timers and were the old timers, but they were still a generation from the initial pioneers, whatever, pretty much. But most of those people, their children moved off the island, you know, they were gone and they went to the mainland because all there was here was fishing and farming.
Some of them came back to retire.
A few did,
yeah.
But many of them just established lives away from the island. And when the old-timers saw us coming here, they saw in us the young people that can make a community, and that you have to have both the young, you know, you have to have babies and young people and old people and all that to really make a community. And I think that there was some sense, maybe not even acknowledged by them, that was so and that's needed. And it, of course, is one of the things that's come up in our time is the fact that if you have a community of just rich people or retirees, if people can't afford to pay rent, if no young person can really be able to buy land, then it becomes the end of a certain element of community that makes things, you know, more real life and not an affectation of what, you know, should really be, maybe. But anyway, I, in the very beginning to earn money, I helped, re-roof houses and things like that. And I determined from the very beginning I didn't want to do anything that changed the island. And one of the things that I believe in is good employment, and I have been so lucky in having good employment. And good employment, you know, like there are people that get high degrees in physics and end up dreaming up death machinery at Lawrence Livermore Labs in California. And that's not good employment. You go home to your children at night, and how does that feel? I never had to build houses or such like that. I actually did help build the hangar up at the airport, and a few things like that. But basically, that's not anywhere near where I made my living. And in the very beginning, I just chopped wood and mowed lawns for people using their lawnmower because I certainly didn't own one. And it was a pretty simple life. And I got a hold of a cow and. And over time, I had several of them, but I milked a Jersey cow, and that was a big part of our income. We sold milk for $1 a gallon out of a refrigerator on our porch, and it was just raw milk, and no one ever got sick. And there was a raw milk dairy here at the time, and the state, you know, shut them down, saying that. They thought that they tested him because it's a raw milk dairy and it was a state, you know, a testing program. They tested his cows. This is Paul Oberholzer, OB, and said that they found undulant fever in his cows, which is something that cows can have. And so they said, "Oh, we're going to take away, you know, a bunch of your cows." I think he was milking about 12 at the time, and they took 8 of his milkers away and slaughtered him, gave him no money. And later on, the state vet said, "You know, I don't think your cows ever did have that." But it destroyed the dairy. That was the end, because he couldn't make a living with what they left him with. And so, anyway, it's pretty weird.
So people would just come by, and how much would you sell your milk for?
A buck a gallon. Yeah, we
and
just got
be
gallon.
And then you freezer jar. On your front porch.
Just right out of the fridge on the front porch, and that was that was a lot of our money came from just doing that. You know, now, people don't realize. I mean, we had these little Jersey cows, but our cow would put out its own weight in milk every 18 days for the first 5 months or so of its freshening. And so you get a lot of milk, you know. Yeah. Well, anyway, one thing led to another, and eventually I got a hold of some machinery and decided I would be a farmer. Well, I didn't have any land to farm. We had 20 acres, and I really didn't have land to farm. And I was blessed by the fact that I was able to find land that people would let me use. Okay, who did I tell you earlier? I mentioned
Natalie Rausch.
You know, so generous and so sweet and kind, and has done so much good in this community. And incidentally, you know, those people of Natalie's generation, whatever, and people of means that have come here have really, really done some marvelous things for our community. And we owe them such a debt of gratitude, and on a personal level, but also on a community level. And that is an ongoing good in this community, and I certainly want to congratulate those people. And there's, money in and of itself can be a mixed bag for sure, but the way it has been, we've been the subject of largesse of many of those people has been pretty marvelous. Mm-hmm. And so.
You can congratulate Natalie on her birthday. I think she turned 80.
Yeah. Had a big party. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So she just allowed you to use her land for farming.
She did, yeah. I mean, I think that maybe it was understood that I was going to make, you know, enormous money and me pay her. But, God, Natalie, I'm sorry. I guess I owe you a lot, you know. Oh, boy. I hope you don't listen to this.
There are no gold coins in the ground.
Oh, God. Oh, boy. Well, anyway, 1 year I had oats and wheat and barley and Canadian field peas in the ground, and that I harvested, and as well as doing the hay and stuff like that. And did a lot of custom hay work for other people and stuff. But anyway, I did that for, you know, about 4 years. But in the process of doing that, I got even closer to a lot of the old timers, like Romain, Richie, and Otto, and Phil, who's a neighbor. And so I've always been kind of close to him, all right. But also, especially Pierre Franklin, and I don't know how many people here remember him, but his daughters, twin daughters, Marie and Marie Luckhurst and Valerie Yuckluck, son John Pierre, are still living on Lopez, and are great people. And their father died when they were young, and it was a real tragedy because Pierre was a wonderful man, and he was so good to me. But all those guys were—they were very patient and taught me how to farm, and that was a big deal to me. And so
people are quite willing to share their knowledge.
Oh, yeah. For sure, yeah. Yeah, just absolutely, you know, and pretty. I don't know, pretty necessary too, because, you know, if you just start farming, I mean, farming on that kind of scale where you start plowing up 40 acres of land, well, you know, there's a lot to know about how to go about doing that. Speaking of Marie and Valerie, in 1973, I was the graduation speaker at the school, and it was the only outside graduation they ever had there. And it was on the old tennis court, and Valerie and Marie were a couple of the graduates that year, along with Susie Dengler, Dr. Dengler's daughter, Susie. Mm. And Wilbur Olander played his harpsichord out there. We moved the harpsichord onto the tennis court, and Stanley Greenthal played guitar, and it was pretty sweet.
Oh, my gosh. Hmm. You know, Greg, when I think of you, and already this theme has been coming up today about the largesse of people and the sense of community that we share here on Lopez, and how people are good to each other and make space for each other. And when I think of your name, it's always connected with me on Lopez to community and especially to volunteerism. And although there's, you know, there are very many varieties of volunteerism that go on this island, from retired folks that move here that give a lot of their time to others who volunteer different kinds of resources. But I've been touched in watching one of these groups that you work with here in how you guys rally around folks that are experiencing need on Lopez. You know, we had a death here recently, and the young man died, and your group got together and helped the family get their house finished and so forth. And elders on Lopez who may or may not have the ability to get all the chores done around the place, well, you know, here comes your group of folks. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because to me, that is one of the very special elements that is unique to Lopez these days. And it carries forth this tradition that we've been learning about through all of our interviews about how Lopezians really care for each other and look after each other.
Well, I my own place in that, I have to feel very humble about, because I see people out in this community that work on a scale way, you know, that takes organization, for example, or whatever, way beyond what I've ever been involved with. But we have, there's a little group that I helped to initiate anyway, called the People at Cloud House. And we have a little service organization as part of that that we call Black Dog Society. And the Black Dog Society is essentially men, and then there are the pink poodles, they call themselves, the women that are associated with the group. But anyway, that are like a like a Lions Club thing or something like that. And the Black Dog Society comes from the Lakota Black Dogs that basically it was a warrior society. The young men would take care of the old people, would make sure that they were fed and cared for and stuff. And so it's the same idea. And I think it's a good old American tradition and probably, you know, worldwide, but certainly tribally, you know, people were watched after and cared for. And I don't know, I guess we don't have a chance to really have a tribal society here because it just doesn't work that way anymore in modern times. But we all have that as a root somehow. You know, our families in Europe or wherever were part of tribes, and that was a part of the human experience. And there's a lot of what was... tribal life that was good and nourishing, certainly for a community, because you were dependent on each other. And because we have an island here, we have a unique opportunity to exercise community. And it's you know, it's a pretty great thing in terms of helping with the Fisher's, you know, house and stuff like that. I'm just, like I say, there were so many people that rose up to that, and it was certainly a lot more than anything that I, you know, the Black Dogs or whatever. Those guys were definitely and are definitely part of our, you know, our group or within that sphere of influence in one way or another. But nonetheless, I mean, boy, there was such generosity, and we all, you know, just stood back in awe of the fact that there were, that what was happening was actually happening, because there was a big job to be done. And basically,
it was to finish this home that was...
A long ways along, but on the other hand, there was an enormous amount left to be done. But people just jumped up and said, we're going to do this, you know. Anyway, and did it in a fairly short period of time, too. So that was a good example of community. And like I say, my part in that is not so awfully big, but we have, within the context of the Cloud House people, been... the Cloud House is about is a family... organization. Okay. It's about family. It's about older people, but mostly there's not, you know, so many old timers in that group as there is, you know, middle age people and young people, mm-hmm. and then people with young families and children.
Now, is this biological family or chosen family?
No, I'm saying that's what it's composed of, is these biological families. But the whole thing is obviously chosen.
Okay.
We choose to be together and experience that kind of thing together. And so we do have, you know, some element of, a little tribal thing together. But our helping the community certainly goes beyond this little group,
mm-hmm.
because we want to be able to respond to anybody's need here. Our belief in the community is, you know, is as important as any other beliefs that we might have. And so, and then that's why we have a scholarship that we've been doing every year and that really matters to us. And it's a scholarship for kids that come up with a proposal. They don't have to be graduates of Lopez. They can be anywhere from 16 to, I think, 24. And they can have an idea of something that they want to do that will make a better world, whatever that is, whether it's a college thing or whether it's going to some foreign land and doing something or studying something that will they feel be better for the environment or, you know, whatever their project is. It's not defined.
How do you make it known?
Well, it's been advertised pretty well. It's usually you know, we make sure we put it up on the on any boards on the island and stuff like that. And we also contact kids, and they don't have to have been part of our group either in any way, shape, or form. They can be any kids that are here. And occasionally I see these kids that in the papers will say whether they're graduating from Orcas or from San Juan, and they'll say, I want to do this. And I say, God, that's a kid we should be helping too, you know, because they have, you know, they're not talking about going to a hairdresser school, not that that's a bad thing to do, but they're talking about, you know, whatever, about doing something really good for the earth. Mm-hmm. And you can just tell by what they say in the few words that they say.
In the paper.
That they, those are really amazing children, and they are, really need help to encourage them along those lines. And the one thing is that we so easily, as we get older, lose our idealism. And if there's no other reason why we need young people around is for their idealism. Mm-hmm. So we can remember what's really, truly important. And definitely, it's not a lot of what the dominant society spends its time on. But I'm the one thing also that is really, really true, and that is that, you know, we put our energy into the young people, into young kids, because that is life. That's where society is going to go. And we have kids that go away from here, and they go into the outside world. My daughter, via my marriage to Irene Summermoon, went to college up in Bellingham, and she was in the dorm, and she could not believe how empty-headed the other of her contemporaries were. Mm-hmm. She had vision. She had an idea of a life, and those other kids were like, whoopee, you know, we're away from mom and dad, you know. But people here raise their children, and we believe in raising our children, giving them as much freedom as we possibly can give them. Because what that means is they're responsible. They grow up, and we're not at adversaries with them. We're not at odds with them. They will come to us and share their joys and their sorrows and ask for advice, and they are our friends. And so there is better ways to, you know, be on the earth, and I think that we're trying to figure out what those are and how to do that. But I think that Lopez is the backbone for that.
Could you tell something about the coming of age? Because that would fit in here with talking about young people.
One, you know, the cod house, I guess it will just, we'll go there in just a second, but just to make people, so that people understand what the cloud house is in a certain way, and of course I'm speaking for the rest of that group maybe, but I'm not, because there's no presidents or leaders or chiefs or anything like that, and we just all, you know, do what we do and do it, you know, together, and that's the way it works out. But the cloud house idea, the name, comes from the fact that when the Tlingit people first saw a sailing ship come over the horizon, they looked at those sails, and it was like nothing they'd ever seen before. And when they saw that it was a ship and that there was people on it, they called those people from the clouds. And so they thought they were, because they were white people and they had white sails on their ships, you know, that they were right out of the clouds. And so people at Cloud House is, well, I guess we're a bunch of gringos, you know. Mm-hmm. And here on the Northwest Coast, we have people that belong to houses in a way, or clans, and they lived in what they call big houses. We sometimes call them longhouses, but that's what they had back east. More, they call them, you know, longhouses back east. Here they were called big houses. But anyway, so it's kind of like this eclectic Native American kind of vision of tribal ideas. And so there's nothing defined about that, but it's just, you know, so that people understand where we're coming from. And one of those ideas has always been the idea of passage rites, rites of passage for kids. And the young people would go out and they would take on a challenge, and they would find themselves in that process, or that was what was hoped for. And the people here, the Salish people that were in this area here, would we pattern the kids' rites of passage, coming of age, or whatever people want to call it. But we pattern it a little bit on the vision quest, that idea of a vision quest, mm-hmm. and separating yourself so that you can find out who you are, as opposed to who everybody else is, because you know how kids, a lot of times they get really hung up on, you know, fads and whatever their friends are doing, and they all want to be alike and stuff like that. This is a way of starting to discover yourself, and so we, you know, have put them in situations where they were alone, and you know, not totally safe. They're not in their bedroom, you know. We're not. We're putting them out in nature, and so they have to meet a challenge. And usually we take the kids, what the kids want to do, into account, because we're just babies ourselves, mm-hmm. in this procedure. Mm-hmm. But it seems like most of the kids, that's what they want to do too, mm-hmm. that they've seen that happen. A lot of the kids here that have grown up have never not seen it. They know that that's the way life is, that when their time comes, they will be in that situation. Mm-hmm. And they've seen numerous kids over time, you know, go through that little ceremonial happening and be separated from the group and come back in, be welcomed, and all of that, the ritual and so forth that we do, and all of tradition. As I see, what's important with tradition is that tradition is a place around which you make change. Because if you don't, if it's unchangeable, it's not tradition, it's dogma, you know. And so it's really important that everyone, like I say, the kids' parents, and the community, all works together on that, and all can have their say and their part in it. And the fact of the matter is that we encourage people it's a participatory society, mm-hmm. where participation is what it is. That's what it is. It's about that. It's about being there and joining in. And people, when they, you know, maybe when they first, you know, get involved, just sit back and have to watch a little bit to figure out how they fit in. But maybe they don't, but whatever. But basically, then they will bring their own, you know, gifts to the group. But it has been pretty wonderful to do those rites of passage for those kids, and I can't even begin to tell you how many it's been, you know, but a bunch. Mm-hmm. And it's been going on for a number of years. Last year's summer solstice was the 37th in a row. Wow. And always celebrated on a beach somewhere, mm-hmm. you know, we're always in danger, the group's always in danger of having success be its own undoing, because there's more demand for what we do than what we can accommodate. Mm-hmm. A tribe was basically only so many members before it becomes pretty unwieldy, and next thing you know, you're the Aztecs and you're sacrificing 15 people a day or something. That's like, whoa. Not that one. We're not going there, you know. But anyway, there's only so many people that you can accommodate at one time and keep them together, focused. Sure. And the focus is important, you know, like I say, participation. Mm-hmm. Without that, it just becomes some other kind of an event altogether. Yeah. But
when you talk about all this, then it's clear that for many people on island who came here and came in touch with you, you have kind of become their spiritual leader.
Oh, no. Well, let's not say that. Well, whoa, boy. I'll be in trouble right away now. No, not at all. No. I hope not. And that wouldn't be good. It wouldn't be good for me. No, not at all. No, I think that...
Just a bit of a leader.
Well, something, you know, in some way, but you know, we've got a whole society of leaders, mm-hmm. And there's some of them that are not going to follow me anywhere. And so, and bless their hearts. I mean, I think that's, you know, I mean, it's just, it's really good. But I'm not a leader of the, you know, I mean, in some ways, probably, you know, I because of being an initiator, you know, I've helped to, and also I've always been there. We're just about to have our 37th Thanksgiving, community Thanksgiving on Lopez. Okay. And I was there at the first one. I've been there at every one. I've baked, I don't know how many turkeys with my partner, uh-huh. and cleaned up afterwards and got the key back to the Grange or where it was going and all that. And I definitely work for that society. I work for that community. And a lot of people do mm-hmm. work very diligently because the rewards are so rich. And
your roots are so deep here. Your roots, yeah. And so, and your kids have come back.
Kids have that's a mixed bag. I have a daughter that is doing a doctorate at UCLA.
Okay.
And Irene's child Summer Moon lives on the island. My son Zach lives on the island, and. The rest of the kids have, you know, dispersed, you know, mm-hmm. some, but Irene's son Raven, who's also my adopted son, would love to be on the island if he could possibly be here, but he's a glass artist, and he's definitely got a very, very strong connection to Lopez. He lives up near Stanwood now, near the Pilchuck Glass School. Mm-hmm. And and the other kids, they all, you know, definitely, you know, have gotten a lot from this and enjoy this, you know, society. But Irene's son Cody is a fireman in Seattle.
Okay.
And
but what I find interesting when you talk about being guided by the old timers, I've heard stories about you teaching people who came from the mainland how to build a barn. You helped John Sangster build his barn, and he has often spoken about that, where you were the guide, you know, the one who told him how.
Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun building that barn together.
Yeah,
it was a good time in his life and mine. Mm-hmm. And those are delightful people. And boy, there's just so many, you know, sweet, sweet folks on this island. We are so blessed. You know, we're coming up on Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving has to be my all-time favorite holiday. Mm. It's a secular event. It's not a religious thing. And we all of us Americans, most all of us have so much to be grateful for. Mm. And in my own life, I have realized in the last few years that it's really important to live in gratitude. Mm. I mean, that's just a guiding principle, you know, and every day to be thankful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, there will come a time when we, you know, it's, you know, difficult to be thankful. But while we can be, while we are in health like this, man, we just have to be so celebratory about our wonderful lives. And to have come to Lopez, to have discovered this island, you know, somehow or another, whatever guiding principle or, you know, guardian angels we have or whatever that brought us here and together and are living in this love, why, you know, man, we've got to be thankful. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I think we're about ready to wrap up the show. Does anybody have any last comments or questions or stories you want to throw in the pot before our time?
How much time do we have here?
Oh, heck. We've got another 5 minutes or so if you've got another story.
Okay, well, maybe we'll get a little bit political here, in a way, and that is, and I think that, you know, mostly people on Lopez can understand this, but when Edie and I first moved to Lopez, there was a county sanitarian that lived on Lopez. His name was Ike Shear, and Ike was a great old guy and one of those, you know, practical men, and he
flew
saw
back and forth too.
Yeah. He lived. He was. He had to go back and forth to the other islands, but he lived on Lopez, and he saw us on the ferry, and he knew we were new people because at that time there wasn't so many people that you couldn't kind of know who was coming and who was going, and so he said, you know, I heard you got a place on so-and-so, and we told him, yeah, and he says, what are you going to do for sanitation? And I said, what, you know? He says, well, just wondering what you're going to do, you know, for, you know, bathroom facilities or whatever. And I said, oh, well, we're just going to have an outhouse. He says, oh, that's the best thing. He says, you know, Lopez soils don't perk good. And he said, septic systems just aren't good here. He says, the best thing is to have an outhouse because he says it really contains it and it's just, you know, the best way to go, you know. And of course now on in the islands, the county sanitarian won't even let you have an outhouse unless you purchase it for like $2,000, and it's like, you know, some sort of composting toilety outhouse thing, you know. And it's just crazy because
there are many outhouses on Lopez.
Well, there's a lot, so I've got three of them on my property in different places, but anyway, it's that's kind of, you know, something that's happened here is we've gone from, I mean, when we came to the island, there was the sheriff was named Swede, and he just stayed at home unless you needed him, and he didn't have a uniform, didn't carry a gun. I mean, you know, and that's kind of the way it was back then. And Sheriff Erickson over in San Juan Island was just about the same kind of caliber, you know, and it was just different. And now people do come here with the idea of having not only the beachfront and whatever, but also having all of the benefits of being in the city. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like, where is the bowling alley and all that stuff? And it's no joke. I mean, they've been proposed here before, and you know, there's, you know, things like that are kind of like, well, a person came here and said, oh, my kid likes to skateboard, we need more pavement, you know. And my wife said, you know what, you need to be on the mainland. There's acres and acres of pavement over there. Create pavement so your kid can ride around on a skateboard. Well, lucky they have a skateboard park and stuff. And I mean, I understand people doing that and stuff, but not like feeling bad because Lopez doesn't have much pavement. That's not a good reason to come here. And in terms of the county laws, I mentioned earlier, a friend of mine just finished building a fence and for some people, and the fence was going to be over 6 foot tall, which is necessary to keep deer out of your garden or orchard or whatever. And so the county said that that had to be an engineered fence. And when the engineering was done,
but does an engineered fence
that, well, somebody
has to figure out.
Yeah, somebody has to draw it up. Yeah. Some licensed architect, I guess, has to draw up
money.
A fence, you know. And why, you know, the idea of this fence, you know, like causing a problem because it hadn't been engineered, like falling over and hurting a deer or a cow or something, is just crazy to me. But that's the way the county is. These people are making money administering things that they don't even understand about, because the engineer came up with the idea that the posts had to go 3 foot 6 inches into the ground. I mean, there's old timers here who are going to roll over in their grave when I say this. 3 foot 6 inches into the ground and be set in concrete. And so that is so amazing, because really a fence post will rot off within a foot of the ground surface, period, because that's where dry rot can happen, and that's what takes them away. And so here we've got this big stub with a huge concrete wad on the concrete is a waste. I don't even put rocks in when I put in a fence in the holes, because even though it helps you get it stable quicker, because I know what it's like to dig up a fence post that had rocks in the mm-hmm. hole. It's not as easy as digging up one that was just earth. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's kind of like that. There's a lot of
like
these.
Sounds like you're worried that we're going to lose some of the local knowledge and history. And...
Yeah, right. Well, practicality. You know, I mean, just being practical about things. It's just crazy. And
was the practicality that brought us to the owner builder. But I understand the county would like to get rid of the owner builder.
Listen, I helped initiate that owner builder. I was at the very first meeting in this county. I've been political my whole time in one way or another here, but I was at the first meeting in the county about it, because the reason why we got it in the first place is some building inspector from Seattle decided he wanted to retire to Orcas, and so he thought, oh, I know what, I'll get myself a job. He goes to the county commissioner and say, you don't have a building code here? How come you don't have a building code? Got him talked into it. In the end, two county commissioners were thrown out of office because they put that in, and we got our owner builder code, which the building association for the state of Washington and this local bunch of guys that were builders wanted thrown out because somebody might build their own house, they wouldn't get the money or whatever, you know. And
remember how happy the legislatures were in Olympia, because there were real people here who talked to them. Not, you know, lobbyists of different outfits, but real people. They had a wonderful time with all of us.
Really?
Yeah.
When they came up to get for fact-finding?
When we had to ask for, the laws to be changed.
Mm-hmm. We had presented a petition to the county commissioner with 2,700 names on it, and that was a lot of people back then because there wasn't that many people, but countywide. And this was like rednecks and hippies and everybody else signing it. You know, we were all, you know, of like mind to the fact that, if you want to make a fool out of yourself with your building, well, just go right ahead. And if it falls down on you, well, that's your problem. And we suggested that if a person builds a house and then sells it, which you could imagine happening, somebody just being actually essentially a developer or something like that and wanting to make money on it, they'd have to bring it up to code. Mm-hmm. But if you just build your own place and you're going to live there, you should be able to do that. However, and you know, the Constitution of the United States, the first amendment is that you have the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And I deny anybody saying that housing your family is not a pursuit of happiness, right to life, liberty kind of issue. Mm-hmm. It is. And the Unified Building Code, the UBC, has in the very beginning of it says, if any one word, sentence, paragraph, or chapter of this book becomes ruled unconstitutional, it doesn't affect any other word, sentence, section or chapter. You know, they know it's unconstitutional in a way. Now, I understand it when it comes to public buildings. Mm-hmm. They need to be built to a standard. But if you want to live in a shack because that's what's available to you, but the Unified Building Code is for building inspectors and rejectors. It's for the banks. It's for the building suppliers. It's not necessarily for the poor people.
Mm-hmm. And it may be for people in the city who live right next to each other. But here we still have a little bit of space around us.
Yeah, that's understandable, too.
It's a pretty independent crowd we got out here, too.
And I'm so glad, man. And I'm just so glad. We need to maintain that independence.
You bet. That's what kind of defines us out here. Community and independence and free thinkers.
Yeah, well,
that's absolutely
there isn't one of us that hasn't thought about succession.
Well, Lori was saying that when she goes to Florida to visit family, they consider her a true hippie kind of person.
Yeah. And when I'm here, they think I'm a corporate person.
Oh, no, not at all.
It all depends.
I don't think so.
Because they ask her, have you seen such and such a show? She says, I don't have a TV.
Oh.
You don't have a TV. How can you live without a TV?
Really, think about it.
That's right, or a cell phone either. And they just think I'm some kind of a freak. I just came back from Orlando and we just had this experience. And they said, well, how do you get by?
Yeah.
I said, really, really well.
Yeah.
You know, really, really well. We've run out of time here. So, Greg, thank you so much for your stories and your history and your perspective. It's been a lovely hour together.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thank you. If I said anything out that has offended anybody, forgive me, folks. I love you all, you know.
And we want you to know this program was pre-recorded. Thank you for listening.
See you next time.